Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The facts about the opioid addiction crisis in America never lose their power. Between 2001 to 2016, deaths due to opioids increased almost 350%. And in 2017 alone, more than a third of deaths involved a prescription drug. And that fact, that so many cases of opioid addiction disorder can begin right in the doctor's office, an intimate space that's supposed to be about helping and healing, well, it's forced many medical schools to completely rethink the way they're educating a new generation of doctors about pain and addiction. It's a real sea change in some places, because it wasn't that long ago that some med students were taught that the only solution to most pain was simply more prescriptions. But now, some schools are folding a multifaceted approach into all 4 years of medical school. So this hour on Point, the opioid addiction crisis and the next generation of physicians, we'll go inside a new way to teach young doctors about pain. And we will start today in Providence, Rhode Island. On Point producer Allison Poley visited an interdisciplinary workshop at the Warren Alpert Medical School at Brown University. It's an immersive experience for the students. And here's what happened when Allison and the students first entered an exam room.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, my name is Jason. I'm a 3rd year med student working with the team today.
Okay.
What's your name?
My name is Sheila Jones.
And how would you like to be addressed?
Ms. Jones.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
The students stand on the perimeter of a stark, fluorescently lit exam room. The patient called Sheila Jones is an actor. She sits on an exam table in a medical gown. The students take turns asking her questions.
So what brings you in today?
Basically, you know, I had hurt my back about a year ago, and my pain really never gone away.
There are 7 students in today's exercise. 4 nursing students, a medical student, a 5th-year pharmacy student, and a social work graduate student. This is part of Brown's training approach. The interdisciplinary workshop gives students from across the state the chance to work together.
When you initially got hurt, did they prescribe you anything?
Prescribe me Percocet.
And then how long did you use that for? Do you remember?
They gave me 2 refills on that.
Okay.
Sheila tells the students the Percocet ran out. She took Tylenol, but she wakes up every morning in extreme pain, 8 on a scale of 10.
In the morning, it's really the worst when I have to get up.
Okay.
But throughout the day, it goes down to about a 4.
The group also takes a social history. They ask what she does for work and for fun. Sheila works as an accountant and lives alone, but has a close group of friends. Nothing seems unusual. She says she's doing well despite the pain. The students huddle in the hallway. They struggle to come up with a treatment plan. Should they prescribe something else for the pain? Recommend physical therapy? Then a nursing student realizes there was something they forgot to ask. Had Sheila taken anything that wasn't prescribed to her? It's a simple question, but an important one. It can also be uncomfortable to ask. Figuring out how to go about this is one of the very reasons why Brown has students do this training. But the students are nervous. They go back and forth about who should ask her.
You can just go. Yeah, I mean, maybe you can just probably do it.
You just go.
Go for it.
Finally, med student Jason Siklis offers to go in. The rest of the students wait in the hall.
Hello.
Hi.
So we're wondering, have you ever taken any medications that weren't prescribed you?
That weren't?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll sit down. You want to tell me about it?
Well, when I ran out of my prescriptions that the doctor was giving me, I talked to a friend, and she said she had some stuff.
Some stuff? Was more Percocet. Jason presses Sheila for more information.
How are you feeling about that? Is that something you would like to talk about?
No, I really don't care to talk too much about it. It's expensive,
yeah.
That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is definitely something that I would like to talk to you about because, you know...
Remember, Sheila's acting in the role of a patient. She's being evasive on purpose. When these students are in the field, they will need to work really hard to get their patients to open up. Getting practice doing so is another reason why Brown puts on this workshop. So Jason takes another step and asks if the Percocet is helping to manage her overall pain. That's when Sheila says what's really going on.
I stopped buying the Percs because they became too expensive. Mm-hmm. And I decided to get some heroin, which was cheaper.
Yeah.
So I've been doing the heroin for the past 5 months. Okay.
Jason nods calmly and maintains eye contact with Sheila. He is using an approach called ESPERT. It stands for Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment. The approach encourages empathy and working with patients to set realistic yet optimistic goals for treatment.
I know it's not good. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm basically here, because I need to get some sort of control of my pain.
Well, it's really good that you've come here, that you're in the right place, and we're here to care for you. So that means definitely, hopefully, discussing with you ways to move past heroin or move past this, because, I mean, I don't need to tell you that you seem well aware that this is it's dangerous. You know?
Right, right.
Jason goes back into the hallway and debriefs with the team.
So now this has definitely shifted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little bit.
The students all go back in. They suggest a care plan to Sheila, which includes x-rays to find the root cause of the pain and a treatment program, whether inpatient or outpatient. But one thing is still unclear to Sheila. She has to bring it up herself.
So, meanwhile, I'll be doing the heroin. Are you going to be doing something with what's going on?
Taylor DeRosha, the pharmacy student, jumps in.
There are medications that will help with that, which can also help with your pain. Like, have you heard of, like, Suboxone?
Suboxone is the brand name for a medication that both reduces the craving for opioids as well as the chance of a fatal overdose. Because of federal regulations, clinicians in the United States need a waiver to prescribe it. Each state has its own rules. All of Brown's med students receive training to get the waiver, but they can only prescribe the medication in the second year of their residencies if they practice in Rhode Island. The students recommend Suboxone as part of Sheila's treatment plan.
And we could also do like a recommendation for PT to help you out, maybe see if that will relieve some of the pain rather than just trying to medicate it.
Okay.
The role playing wraps up. The students get feedback from Sheila. She lets them know they did a good job, but they missed a few important things.
I was waiting for you to ask about, you know, illicit drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay.
I'm not going to make it easy for us.
And even you didn't really ask about recreational drugs. You just asked about other prescriptions.
Yeah.
But I let you know.
It's tough. Doctors' offices are intimate spaces where difficult conversations happen. And not all patients will offer up information like Sheila. But the point of exercises like these are to ensure that medical students have this experience while they're still in the classroom. The med student Jason Siklis says this interdisciplinary approach will inform how he thinks about pain throughout his career.
Pain has an emotional quality to it. People will feel pain, and it will manifest in other ways. And so having the broader picture, I think, is really important.
It's something Paul George, Associate Dean of Medical Education at Brown, wishes he had. He remembers having just one or two lectures about pain when he was in med school.
So we're playing the catch-up game. We have to learn sort of on the go about medication-assisted treatment and treating pain. And so I'm sort of sad that we didn't get this kind of education when we were in med school, but glad that our students are, and glad that, physicians from my generation and other health professionals are taking it seriously and getting this extra training in order to serve individuals who are suffering from opioid use disorder.
That report from On Point's Allison Poley, reporting from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. We are talking this hour about the opioid addiction crisis and changing the way new doctors are trained in medical school on how to treat pain and addiction. And you can join us. Doctors, I mean, how does medical education need to change in the light of what we now know about addiction and patients? I guess that means most of us. What have your experiences been like in the doctor's office when issues of dependence come up? or don't come up? How do we make clinics a place of help and healing in light of the opioid addiction crisis? Now, Brown University was one of four medical schools recently honored by the American Association of Medical Colleges for their work in training the next generation of doctors on how to treat pain. The other honored medical schools were the University of Massachusetts Medical School, the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, and the University of Michigan School of Medicine. And joining us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Dr. Michael Engelsby, professor of surgery at the University of Michigan Med School in the section of transplant surgery. He specializes in kidney and liver transplantation in adults and children. Dr. Engelsby, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Also with us from Louisville, Kentucky, is Dr. Kelly Clark. She is the immediate past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine and founder of Addiction Crisis Solutions, a company that's focused on transforming addiction care into evidence-based, cost-effective practice. Dr. Clark, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Engelsby, first of all, let me just start with you. How different is the education going on at the University of Michigan, or what we heard just now from Brown at the med school there, than what you had when you were in med school?
I can't recall. I mean, it's unfortunately been over 20 years, but I can't recall specific education around pain. I think we probably got some education around addiction at the time. I think the cocaine epidemic was the primary kind of addiction challenge in the public health. But I don't think we got much. I think the way – I'm a surgeon, so the way surgeons who write for lots of the opioids in the United States learn are your first day as a resident, you ask the person sitting next to you kind of how many pills do you give for this procedure. I think that's about it. That number continued to get more and more over the past decade or two, and surgeons were kind of writing for more and more opioids. But
right. Specific
education, nothing.
Well, now we're seeing in places like Michigan and Brown and others a multifaceted and interdisciplinary approach to teaching about addiction and pain. So we're going to explore that more when we come back. So Dr. Engelsby and Dr. Clark, stand by here for just a moment. We are talking about a new way to train the next generation of doctors on how to treat pain and how to approach issues of addiction disorders in the light of all we know now, given the opioid addiction crisis in America. Want to hear from you. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the new way that some medical schools in America are training the next generation of doctors on addiction and addiction disorders and prescriptions, even, given all we now know about the opioid addiction crisis in America. I'm joined today by Dr. Michael Engelsby. He's a professor of surgery at the University of Michigan Medical School. Dr. Kelly Clark also joins us. She's past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And Dr. Clark, let me just ask you, how important of a nexus are medical schools and the training that new doctors or would-be doctors get on addiction? How important is it to use this as a place to make some progress in treating the opioid addiction crisis in America?
Medical schools are absolutely pivotal as a point of inflection. I'm a psychiatrist, so that means after college, I had 4 years of medical school and 4 years of psychiatric residency training. And my training in addiction was 2 months during that 4 years of psychiatric training. And since I trained, that's been decreased to 1 month. So as we now know, addiction is a chronic brain disease, and we need to approach it the same way we do other chronic diseases. And that really means a multidisciplinary, biological, psychological, social approach that really has the physician as that captain of the ship. And where we have come from is a space where we didn't have addiction medicine specialist physicians, which we have now. It's hard to train medical students and resident physicians unless you have board-certified experts at the medical schools. And we simply don't have enough even of those experts at this point to do the training we need.
Right. It is remarkable about how different this new way of thinking about medical education is from years past. I mean, as Dr. Anglesby was telling us before the break, as a young transplant surgeon, basically what he learned was from older doctors, like, how many pills did you prescribe? And that was the extent of the education. I in years past have spoken to physicians who said, well, things went so far as to train doctors that if someone comes in with what looks like a dependence on a prescription, that because they were exhibiting pain, that they had this thing called pseudo addiction, and the best solution was to prescribe more opioids. I mean, it's exactly the opposite of how we think about this now, Dr. Clark, isn't it?
Well, very interesting point here. And so let me make just a clarification between what we would call dependence and what we call addiction.
Okay, please do.
So dependence is something where your body gets used to something, some kind of substance. So if I gave you a pain pill 3 times a day or to take 2 3 times a day, and after a month I told you to stop immediately, your body would likely go through withdrawals. Your stomach would cramp, you'd have nausea and diarrhea and sweats, and you would hurt and you'd feel miserable. It looks like the flu. And that's physical dependence. And basically all we need to do for that is literally give you some opioids again and then taper you down gradually, and then that goes away. Addiction is really a chronic brain disease that impacts specific circuits in the brain, and it causes damage to the brain that we've really not seen change. So it's this new understanding that addiction is really a disease in and of itself, not just a behavior or not just a physical adaptation, that is something that's fairly new for medicine.
I see. So Dr. Anglesby, let me turn back to you here. Can you just tell us in a little bit more detail what the University of Michigan Medical School is doing that garnered this award, this attention from the American Association of Medical Colleges?
Great. Thank you. Two things. One is pretty much the same thing that the story detailed at Brown University, where all of our students have required pain and addiction content that they have to take to graduate, and then all students will be kind of credentialed to have a waiver to prescribe Suboxone if they choose to later in their practice. But I think kind of in a more innovative vein, as momentum and experts like your guest educated the medical community about the crisis, we really, I think, empowered the best and brightest at our institution, which is usually these young medical students, to try to fix the problem. And one student started with a very simple endeavor where he asked all the patients, took their gallbladder out, how many pills did you take? And he realized that we were giving many-fold more pills than people were taking. But then a small number of patients, about 6%, continued to take them long-term after their operation. So being aware of kind of the trajectory of how people kind of become dependent on opioids after dental care and surgical care. And then two is this young student kind of led what we call prescribing recommendations. So we have kind of evidence-based opioid prescribing recommendations that we now launched across the entire state of Michigan for all common operations. And they are manyfold fewer pills with much better pain care. We're not just taking pills away and leaving people in pain. Learning how to talk to patients about pain, right, making sure that they're getting excellent care has been key.
Well, so, I mean, manyfold, there's a specific number, right, that you had that student had found that that people were being prescribed on an average of something like 45 pills, but most folks were taking only six. That's quite a difference.
Yeah, and there's lots of leftover pills.
Yeah.
So, for example, on that the patient in the previous talk, that woman was getting her pills within the community, and there's literally hundreds of millions of pills in our communities that are left over from dental prescribing or surgical prescribing. So we now, at the University of Michigan, patients get four opioid pills after laparoscopic cholecystectomy, as opposed to they used to get 45, and pain care is better than ever.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We have a lot of callers who want to join us, so let me just bring them in here. Sebastian's calling from Tampa, Florida. Sebastian, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I recently had oral surgery, and before the surgery, I confided in the doctors and nurses that I am a recovering addict, and then I wasn't informed of the amount of pain I would be in after the surgery, and I was prescribed Percocet, which luckily enough for me, I have a support system that I didn't end up falling back into drugs. But I think listening and being cognizant of your patient as an individual is definitely a good first line of defense.
Yeah. Well, Sebastian, thank you so much for your call. You know, Sebastian just said that he wasn't informed by his medical team after his oral surgery about how much pain he might be in. Interestingly, that's exactly one of the points that the University of Massachusetts Medical School's Graduate School of Nursing is educating its students more about. So this is Jill Terrian. She is an associate professor of nursing and medicine at the University of Massachusetts, and she talked about how the school's curriculum is changing.
In our curriculum now, we are more deliberate about you're going to have pain. If you had surgery, you are going to have pain, and let me tell you about it and what to expect. And we need to do more and more of that so that patients, A, don't expect that they're going to get opioids because that's what they've always gotten, and B, that might not be the best treatment for them.
That's Jill Terrian from the University of Massachusetts Medical School's Graduate School of Nursing. Dr. Clark, our caller Sebastian talked about basically discussions with his providers that didn't lead to what might have been the best outcome for him. But thankfully, he had that community surrounding him. I mean, isn't that at the heart of this new way of thinking, that there needs to be better, more multifaceted conversations between care providers and patients?
You're exactly right. And Sebastian did exactly the correct thing. He told his clinician about his history of addictive disease and that, of course, he would be at risk again because what happens in the brain is that there are changes in specific areas of the brain. And if the brain is again exposed to an opioid, then that can really reactivate that active addictive disease. But unfortunately, his provider did not, you know, respond in the way that one would hope that the clinician responds. And so to the point of training new doctors in medical schools, and really we see, I have great hope, because medical students are demanding treatment, demanding education, in the treatment of addiction, despite it may not being offered in some locations. They're really seeing the need. But we have to get to those who are physicians, dentists, others who are in active practice currently as well.
Yeah.
And I think of this in the discussion with the patient that you just played in that clip as being very much like one of your programs last week, which is managing the expectations of the patient so that they know what to expect. Patients often expect if they come in with something that seems like a cold that they'll get an antibiotic, which is often the exact worst thing to do. And here they may expect that their pain will go away, or that a pain pill's job is for to make all pain go away, which is an unrealistic expectation. So helping to educate the public as well as providers is going to be really important here.
Dr. Anglesby, you know, in the in the piece that our producer, Allison Poley, provided to us, taking us inside one of these immersive interdisciplinary workshops using person who's in the playing the role of a patient. The thing that I've heard this piece several times now, and every single time I come away with this feeling of, this is not easy. It's hard to have these conversations. What are the skills, the sort of empathic skills that nurses, physicians, social workers all need to have in order to form a sense of partnership with their patients and to also help them get to the truth? Because not all patients are going to be as forthright as the people in these, in these role-playing scenarios.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think empathy is the key word that, all of us who go into medicine, come in with that. And I think the busyness of life practicing medicine can really make it hard to have the really hard, meaningful conversations with our patients. But I can't state enough how multidisciplinary it is. Just an example, we looked at who educates families about pain when children have their appendix removed, common operation. And there's over 40 kind of individuals just in our institution who educated the family about pain. And that's about, as simple as it gets. So involving everyone in the continuum of care to kind of do it in a patient-centered way and to really have the courage to ask the hard questions that may keep them in the room another hour while they're trying to see, four patients an hour, so to speak. But that is best care. And I'm optimistic, as our other guest, that with our best and brightest demanding this from us, the medical establishment, that this problem is on its way to getting fixed in our society. It's just going to take a long time.
Well, here's one of the reasons why young medical students are increasingly demanding this kind of training. Dr. Melissa Fisher is a professor of medicine and associate dean for undergraduate education at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. She told us about a trend she's seeing.
One of the tragedies that I've noticed in working with our first-year students is that basically when we start to talk about this in first year, there's not a small group that I've participated in where there hasn't been a student who has been able to share how this has impacted them directly, whether it be classmates in high school, family members, family friends. This is an epidemic and a disease that is impacting our students profoundly.
That's Dr. Melissa Fisher, professor of medicine at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Let's go to Nathan, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Nathan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. It's a pleasure to be with you. I am a resident physician, actually, in my residency training, and I'm very much interested in this topic. I actually did some of my residency training in Dayton, Ohio, which is one of the epicenters of the opioid crisis. My comment is I think that the primary prevention of addressing this issue with medical students coming up in training is a good one. I feel that myself, graduating just several years ago, we actually had a very strong focus on this in my medical school. Some patients may even argue too strong a focus, because a lot of myself and my classmates, I think, have almost a fear to prescribe opioids at this point. And I wonder if while we're talking about the issue of prescribing opioids, we don't have quite the strength of a focus on the alternative treatments that we should be addressing, the psychological aspect of pain, coping mechanisms, physical therapy, those kind of alternative treatment options to prescribing opioids. I just worry that as we focus so much on, avoid opioids or try to minimize opioids, that we don't supplant that with some of the alternative strategies.
Well, Nathan, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Clark, let me turn to you on that. And Nathan brought up actually two things. First of all, let's get to what he ended with which is, is there room in med school education, and then perhaps even more broadly, in the medical system that they graduate into, to bring in these alternative therapies that could form a holistic treatment for a person?
Well, sure, because what he talked about weren't really holistic. They were holistic, but they are in no way marginal therapies. Yeah. Helping a person manage their chronic disease or their chronic condition, if it's an addictive disease, if it's chronic pain, if it's diabetes, whatever it is, really requires working with that patient and their family and their support system to help them a day at a time, a moment at a time, manage that disease, hopefully to, you know, decrease the signs and symptoms so they're not there, which we call remission, or to live their best lives, which we call recovery. And exactly to your point here, Magna, is that our system into which the physicians graduate has not supported that multidisciplinary approach. The coverage for physical therapy, the coverage for psychology, pain psychologists, for multidisciplinary approaches to pain management has really been negligible. And even, you know, it's hard to get psychiatrists to do addiction medicine fellowships because they're not going to be, you know, they're not seeing a return on investment of that in terms of payments as well. So the structure that we have now of having treated addiction like a social or a moral problem with social approaches only versus where we need to be with a whole continuum of care that's logical is really the same issue we have with pain management, that we have not built and in some cases have dismantled a multidisciplinary infrastructure that is so needed.
Right. Well, we are talking this hour about a new way to educate the next generation of physicians and nurses and social workers, virtually everyone in the healthcare field, about addiction and pain treatment, given all that we know regarding the opioid addiction crisis. I'm joined today by Dr. Kelly Clark. She's past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Dr. Michael Engel is also with us. He's a professor of surgery at the University of Michigan Medical School. What needs to change in how med schools train future healthcare professionals when it comes to the opioid addiction crisis? This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the opioid addiction crisis and changing the way new doctors, new medical professionals are trained in medical school on how to treat pain and addiction. There is a lot of innovation going on in some medical schools in the country, and four of them were recently honored by the American Association of Medical Colleges for their work on this front. They are Brown University, the University of Massachusetts Medical School, the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, and the University of Michigan School of Medicine. And here's the voice of a student, Paul Wallace, who graduated just this past weekend from Brown Medical School, or Brown's Medical School. He's now going to focus on addiction psychiatry during his residency at the University of California, San Francisco. And he went through Brown's training on addiction. And he told us why he thinks it's important that all med students get training to prescribe a certain drug.
It helps dispel the notion that treating opioid use disorder is purely the domain of addiction specialists or primary care doctors, when truly all different types of physicians are going to encounter patients with opioid use disorder, whether it be an emergency physician who's seeing a patient after an overdose or an obstetrician who's working with a pregnant patient with opioid use disorder.
And Paul Wallace there is talking about buprenorphine, a drug that can be used to treat patients with addiction disorder. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Stephanie, who's calling from Meriden, New Hampshire. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you all? I thank you for this. I've been an RN for 40 years now, so I'm kind of back up a little bit. And I was there when physicians weren't giving enough meds, and then they're starting to get sued because they weren't paying attention to the medicine, and then they changed it into the fifth vital sign, which they need to talk about. And so then they started prescribing all these drugs because they were told that they'd be sued if they didn't. And now they're in this position in between where they're like, what do we do, you know? Do we order them or don't we order them? And, you know, a couple of the med students and people were talking about that. We don't know what to do, so we just ask someone else, what do we do? And it's really frustrating to have to watch them, the physicians, go through this when they're being told what to do.
Well, Stephanie, thank you for your call. Dr. Inglesby, let me turn to you. First of all, Stephanie mentioned that medical students for years were trained to talk to view pain as the fifth vital sign, and that being really central to this conversation. What did she mean by that?
Yeah, about 15 years ago, there's a big movement to make sure that nurses and particularly physicians were attending to patients' pain. And there's complexity behind kind of why that happened in our healthcare system, and lots of kind of conspiracy perspectives. But nonetheless, I was training during that time. I remember it vividly. And I think particularly nurses their job is to advocate for best care for the patients. And they, asked to assess patients' pain multiple times while they're in the hospital, and we as physicians were charged with acting on it. And the fifth vital sign, you know, just like your heart rate, your blood pressure, became kind of fundamental to your job as a physician, is to treat the pain. Unfortunately, I think many of us took kind of a naive way, perspective on how to do that, and we basically just used opioids. And obviously, as we've learned, treating pain is a much more complicated process than just giving patients a pill. And right. We've certainly learned the hard way.
Well, Dr. Kelly Clark, you know, before the break, we heard from another caller who was a resident, I believe, who was talking about how he sees amongst his colleagues now kind of an increasing fear of prescribing opioids. And the other caller we just had said, as a nurse, she's feeling bad for doctors, watching them trying to figure out the best way forward. Point taken. But every time we have one of these conversations, I also hear from people who are part of, you know, who are suffering from chronic pain. And they have a concern that as our understanding of pain and addiction evolves, that perhaps it'll be more difficult for the chronic pain community to get the treatment that they need. So is that part of – should that be part of how this new approach – what this new approach looks at?
Oh, such a great question. You know, I would argue that the pain community already has problems getting the care that they need. But what may become more difficult in the future is getting the care that they're used to, meaning opioids. And hopefully what can happen is that we will be able to do all of the modalities that help a person deal with their chronic pain. You know, the evidence there is not evidence that using opioids in a chronic manner for chronic back pain saves lives or improves functionality. In fact, it can actually make baseline pain worse. But what we do have is excellent evidence that using the three FDA-approved medications that we have for opioid use disorder, which are methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, actually save lives. They improve functionality. They are all around the kinds of evidence for ongoing medication use that we want to see. But what we have gotten through our stigma is a language calling the use of those medications for addiction medication-assisted treatment, when in reality, they're simply medication treatment, when we should be calling opioids for chronic pain use medication-assisted treatment, because they're the primary treatment, is not the medication.
Okay. So, Dr. Inglesby, though, but this notion of medicated-assisted treatment, though, is something that we're hearing a lot more from medical schools in regards to getting new doctors certified to prescribe things like Suboxone, though, right?
Yes, indeed. And I think that why it's exciting that this is happening at the medical school level is that essentially there is a workforce shortage of people who can do this best care. So at my own institution, you're much more likely to run into a liver transplant surgeon in the hallway than an addictionologist. And there are, you know, counties in the state of Michigan where there aren't people who can prescribe these medications, or for that matter will see a patient who has opioid use disorder or addiction. And patients will have to drive, you know, hundreds of miles to see a provider, which isn't really feasible. So I think it comes down to creating a workforce that can kind of do best care for these patients in pain and these addicted patients.
Well, let's go back.
I could not possibly agree anymore. It's just imperative that doctors and everyone get over a concept that taking medication for opioid use disorder is substituting one drug for another, or is, you know, all of that, which is just that's not the case. It's medical treatment, and it's incredibly important.
But to be clear, I mean, isn't part of the stumbling block here federal regulations that doctors have to receive a waiver from their states in order to prescribe these things, and unlike oxycodone, OxyContin, which they can prescribe the day they become a physician, right?
Well, that's correct, but we have many more limitations to doctors using buprenorphine than simply an 8-hour training would suggest. We have payment problems that health plans won't pay for non-psychiatrists to do this work. We have regulatory problems in the states that impose additional burdens. In looking at a study of rural doctors, 1 in 7 don't use buprenorphine because their fear of intrusion by the DEA.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have multiple issues beyond just an 8-hour course that keep physicians from offering this care.
Interesting. Okay, so let's go back to our callers. Nicholas is calling from Belfast, Maine. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm a recent graduate of the School of Social Work at the University of Maine. I had training as a behavioral health integrated student clinician. I just wanted to put in a plug for the importance of embedding clinical social workers in the primary care setting, who are really trained behavioral health experts in treating chronic pain and addiction, and also just to put in a plug for mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy approaches. One that comes to mind is acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a really great therapy modality that really helps people manage chronic pain.
Yeah. Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Clark, I want to turn back to you on this, because this is a question that keeps also coming up in my mind. Thinking back to that report we heard at the top of the hour about the immersive interdisciplinary training that's happening at Brown University and other places, because in the simulation that the students underwent, they walked into a clinical setting with a patient, with a team, the doctor, some nurses, social workers, et cetera, in what was ostensibly a primary care setting. I don't know how many places in America, once you're out of medical school, that's what you get when you walk into a primary care physician's office. So, you know, how much of a gap is there?
There is a tremendous gap there. And even when it's not a team that's walking in together, it really requires a team approach, even when they're being seen asynchronously. So having a care coordinator that can help coordinate your care, somebody who can reach out to you and make the connections and ensure your questions are answered, and all of those things that will happen that don't involve an entire group of people coming into your room. But where we do have a problem in terms of addiction is a lack of a workforce.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lack of doctors who are specialized in this. We only have about 50 fellowship programs in the country right now, and we need to fund many, many more of them. There are only about 4,000 of us in the entire country. There are 10 times as many psychiatrists. We have problems with our psychotherapy or counseling workforce. In most places, the folks that are doing the counseling are not master's level, independently billable psychotherapists, the way you would think of doing mental health. And most people doing mental health work don't do addiction work. And most psychiatrists don't do addiction work. Our workforce needs as part of our infrastructure are really enormous.
Yeah. Well, let's get at least another call here. Rich is calling from Brooklyn, Connecticut. Rich, you're on the air.
Hello. My name is Rich. I'm an old Vietnam veteran. I'm now a registered nurse. So I've taken care of some pretty traumatic patients in terms of the need for pain control. And over my entire career, I'm now retired. However, including myself being a patient, what I've noticed is that as trends have gone, one-day surgeries, moving people to the street quicker, out of the hospital settings, what we do is we fail the patient because we put it all on them. I can tell you that pain management is huge, and I admire all the efforts that are being suggested today on the radio. However, the system is that everyone kicks everyone to the curb and leaves it on the patient.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at that.
Rich, thank you for your call. Dr. Engelsby, how would you respond to Rich?
Yeah, I think his point is well taken. Just to throw some data on his observation, for example, in the state of Michigan, the percent of operations done as outpatient have gone up, and they're now over 70% of all the procedures. So most people aren't in the hospital, and even if you are in the hospital, as soon as you can get out of bed, we pretty much discharge you home. And there's good reasons for that, but the point being is part of the trend of giving people more and more opioids, it was related to getting them out of the hospital more quickly. And what happens to patients is you have surgery, you take your bottle of pills, and then when the pills are out, you feel really bad because you're starting to have withdrawal. And many patients, upwards of 5 or 6% of people, would get stuck on these opioids long term. That is a root cause of the opioid epidemic. And part of that is related to efforts, just the financial realities of surgery in the United States and getting people out of the hospital.
Mm. Dr. Engelsby, let me ask you, you're a transplant surgeon. I mean, how did you get involved in the new way of thinking or the new education that's happening at the University of Michigan Medical School?
Yeah, I think about 5 years ago, as a transplant surgeon, you take out organs and you put them in. So I was on the donor duty, so to speak, and I was flying around the Midwest, and I had three donors in a row that were opioid overdoses, a young girl after a sports injury, a young girl after wisdom tooth extraction, and another young person who was at a graduation party and experimented with opioids and alcohol. And it was literally within a 36-hour period. I hadn't heard anything about the opioid epidemic at the time, but it really kind of struck me something that, you know, anyone with a platform ought to do something about. So, you know, we all have opportunities. I do a lot of research. I partnered with some other health services researcher, and then I run the third and fourth year medical school curriculum. So I empowered a lot of these young people that I work with to explain to them, you know, my observation, and they start fixing the problem for us. So I can't say enough that I am optimistic this societal problem will get fixed, and it's going to be these young folks mm-hmm. at these medical schools across the country that are going to do it.
Well, let's go to Amy, who's calling from New Orleans. Amy, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll make this really fast. I just wanted to put in my 2 cents worth as a retired social worker who's been on many teams and also as a retired neurosurgery patient who's had 3 major surgeries. The role of listening among the healthcare team, the patient needs to feel that there's someone that they can tell their entire story to who can hold it, who can contain it, and who isn't going to the next chart or the next lesson mm-hmm. or the next teaching track. And sometimes it's the pastoral care person on a Saturday morning who isn't my religion, and sometimes it's my neurosurgeon. But it has to be somebody who will take that role
yeah.
on the team, especially when I'm acutely sick.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Clark, we've just got about a minute here left to go. We have been focusing on sort of the extraordinary new ways that a handful of medical schools in the nation are addressing this issue. I'm wondering, where would you like to see the bulk of medical schools go next? What more do we need to do?
Well, I think we need to do 2 things. First, we need to do the kind of training that we've always done, which are, you know, lectures. Here's the science. This is what this disease is like. This is how this disease should be treated. So that's one thing we need to do. Next, we need to make sure that every medical school has a board-certified addictionist capable of teaching the students on faculty, and we don't have that now. And then the third thing we need to do is to train our doctors just the way that's being done now in in being able to therapeutically say no to patients. This is a problem with antibiotic overutilization. This is a problem with a lot of things that we do. We need to get our clinicians comfortable with understanding the difference between what a patient needs, what they could benefit for, and what they want, and their responsibilities to listen to and help guide around each of those three different things.
Well, Dr. Kelly Clark is the past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine and founder of Addiction Crisis Solutions. Dr. Clark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dr. Michael Englesby, professor of surgery at the University of Michigan Medical School in the section of transplantation surgery. Dr. Englesby, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can find all our original reporting on the opioid crisis and the new ways to educate medical students about this. All that reporting is at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.